Good morning to you, and welcome to Daily Connection here on KDOT. Oh, we got a great program ahead because it's time for our monthly hit of church history here with friends Matt McAuliffe and Chris White. Once a month we do, we've mostly been looking at famous people in our family album, if you will, of, wonderful saints. And, well, today we're going to be speaking about a woman I really don't know a whole lot about, guys. I had to ask somebody, oh, who is this Amy Semple McPherson? And I found out. And she was, maybe I should just let you guys get going.
I thought she was a Chinese missionary until a month ago when Chris said he had a researcher.
Yes, absolutely. Actually, Amy Semple McPherson is who we know as the founder of the International Church of the Four Square Gospel. Mm-hmm. And that comes from an interesting epiphany she had in about 1921. She was all of 31 years old, and she had a vision right out of Ezekiel chapter 1, in which she saw the face of an ox, an eagle, a man, and a lion, and interpreted them to be significant as far as the fourfold message of salvation, baptism in the Spirit, divine healing, and the second coming of Christ. Mm-hmm. And she took that as a message from the Lord that was the gospel she was going to preach. You needed to be saved. You needed to be healed. You needed to be baptized in the Spirit. And you needed to be ready for the second coming of Christ. And those were the humble beginnings, really, in her mind of the International Church of the Four Square Gospel.
Which today boasts some 30,000 churches, 2 million members, 200 mission groups. It's quite a large chunk of our brethren and sistren, if you will.
Well, when did this all take place? Was that the beginning of...
That's the beginning of the church. But, of course, we digress and go all the way back to 1890 in, what was the town? It was in Salford, Ontario, Canada. Amy Semple McPherson was born in Canada. And in 1903, by the time she's 13 years old, she's actually showing promise of being a very gifted public speaker. Mm. In fact, though, at that particular point in life now, how someone at 13 years old can be a committed atheist, she's purported to have been an atheist at this particular point in her life, and actually was quite fascinated with evolution and would get in public debates in their small community and was known for being a very good debater for the pro side of evolution.
This was the cultural milieu.
Partially also, in reaction to her mom, Minnie was a really devout Salvation Army gal, and Amy probably heard more about the Lord and the gospel than she really cared to hear in her formative years, and so that might have been a teenage reaction. Well, needless to say, it didn't count for much. How old was she, 17?
17, and she goes to a little tent meeting, an evangelistic rally with a Pentecostal evangelist by the name of Robert Semple. And she basically, in her own memoir, says she went down to poke fun of him, kind of to go down and have a hoo-ha at his expense. And she goes down there, and of all things, she gets saved.
How about that?
Wow.
Holy Spirit?
Right. That's something. And she's gonna watch out for those tent meetings.
That's
boy.
Right. Hey. So at this particular point, she gets saved and she asks God, how am I to serve you? And he says to her, I want you to be a winner of souls. And not to impugn motive or anything, but she also just happens to fall in love and marry the evangelist Robert Semple within 6 months of that, which, it'd stand to reason that you'd want to be a soul winner if you were going to marry a soul winner.
And lest you think that this is just one of those easy stories, they both decided they needed to be missionaries in China, went off and, oh my gosh, within a year, Christopher, he died of dysentery, and right after she gives birth to their son, just a horrible mess. Even though it's interesting how the Lord works things together. What's the story where they went and talked to an English philanthropist?
That's right. Well, he was an Irishman, and so they, in those days, of course, you didn't fly to China. You took the boat to China. And so they took the normal route, which was via England and then around the Cape Horn and all that to get to Hong Kong.
Still drumming up mission support.
And
yes, like today.
So they go out to England. They go to meet his parents, who live out there, meet the family and everything. But
they're missionaries in China, or
something? They're preparing for mission work in China. And anyway, one of the things that they want to do, there was a well-known millionaire in England who was a very devout Christian, and they were hoping that he was going to help them with their outgoing expenses to help them get to China. And they met with him and everything, and on the last night of their tour of England, there was a rally going on at the Royal Albert Hall in London, and this Christian gentleman was apparently in charge of the speaking platform, and he asked Amy, of all people, who had never preached a day in her life, asked her to come and give the message before 15,000 people that night. And she, you know, thinks to herself, well, I've never done this before, but on the other hand, we're kind of hoping this guy is going to give us a donation tomorrow as we leave to go to China. And so she gets up, and she picks a verse at random out of the Bible, and she holds this crowd of 15,000 people spellbound with her preaching skills. She's just this dynamic preacher. And indeed, it all works out. The next morning, they leave for China, and the millionaire gives them a gift of $15.
15 clams.
What a guy. There'll be rewards in heaven for him. Yes, sir.
Tell you what, that was something else, eh?
Well, you know, from all of this, God over there, it was terrible from the word go. And Semple died. Amy came back just confused, disoriented, came back, stayed with her mom.
In Canada.
Yeah.
By this time, her mother had separated from her father, they were living in New York, so she comes back to the United States.
But it's not long before she really feels a pull. She's active in church, and she's doing all the things she's supposed to do, but she can feel a tug at her heart. She can feel God's voice really calling out to her to use this gift that suddenly has become obvious, that she has the ability to talk to people in huge numbers and really rivet their minds and souls and hearts. And she's fighting this. She's really fighting to the point where her health begins to deteriorate. It almost reminds me of Florence Nightingale.
Absolutely. You know? And she remarries as well. In this very short time period, she meets a businessman by the name of Mr. McPherson, Harold McPherson. Mm-hmm. And so that's how, you know, we get the name Amy Semple McPherson. That's her That's her second husband. And he's a businessman. And they have another child. And it's actually at this particular point in time where she gives birth to her son and then goes into an incredible deep postpartum depression.
Boy, unbelievable.
And does not seem to be getting better. Actually has an operation even to maybe try to help ease this this problem, this physical problem she's having.
And all the doctors are thinking, this is it, she's gone.
She's going to die. Anyway, she agrees, makes a deal with the Lord. The Lord confronts her on this, and she says, I will go and win souls. You know, and she immediately improves and gets better, you know, whether, of course, you know, we can never question whether, you know, that was God directly dealing with her, whether this was something she realized she was being disobedient to that first calling. We don't know what was going on there, but we know that a couple of years later, she's actually on the road and becomes an itinerant evangelist on the East Coast.
Now, are we talking pre-World War I here?
Absolutely.
This is pre-Depression. Okay.
1915. Pre-World War I.
So by the time 1918, the end of World War I is rolling around, she has purchased a 1912 Packard, nicknamed the Gospel Car. She paints it with religious sayings, and she and her mom and the two kids drive cross-country from the East Coast to Los Angeles. And my understanding is that's the first time recorded that two women alone traversed the United States in an automobile or by any means. It was still the Wild West, for goodness sake.
Yeah,
I mean, people were still getting shot in the middle of Dodge City. And they made it, and she just abandoned caution at this point after that postpartum depression and vision and near-death experience. And so she just uses any opportunity. You know, she'll just walk up to a group and start talking. She'll walk into a bar and start talking. And people are listening. And so when they get to when she gets to L.A., she's immediately, embraced by... Did an Assemblies of God really made her an evangelist officially?
Yeah, she joins the Assemblies of God. And we might also add that as she begins rising into prominence as a itinerant evangelist, that she also loses her marriage. That her marriage with Harold McPherson falls apart. And so once again, she finds herself in a position of being a single woman again. And really, the rest of her life, she was married one other time later on, but it was a very brief period of time. She is loved by, you know, thousands upon thousands and thousands of people, but really she is unable to have just the common love of a marriage, of that sort of thing. She always struggled with family problems. and a lot of dysfunction in that particular area of her life.
Oh, yeah. Even her mom, who always was with her all her life as kind of her business manager and helper, and even her daughter, I found when she grew up later. I just really, this was not a functioning, happy, well-adjusted family. And it's just one of the things that tickled us as we read more and more about Amy's life is the fact that the Lord does not actually seem to require this of us. It's more for our benefit that he tries to teach us to go with the flow and listen to the Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
But the absence of the fruit of the Spirit is not a hindrance to God. He will still use our efforts. And boy, he used Amy's. Is it fair to say that she was a passionate, unguarded, even indiscreet person?
I would say that would be a wonderful characterization of her, with quite a flair. She was definitely a woman of verve.
Theatrical.
And style, and always wore the very, very best clothing money could buy, dressed very stylishly,
mm-hmm.
and then even in the pulpit. She had this interesting vision. Now, her mom was with the Salvation Army, and when she began organizing her church, she organized it along the lines of the Salvation Navy, which I guess is yet for someone to come up with the Salvation Air Force, you know, but maybe somebody already has thought of that. But she would wear kind of a white dress that looked very similar to a Navy suit, a sailor suit, and then she wore a cape. And this was kind of her typical attire for her evangelistic
work. These meetings were, they were spectacular and theatrical. Would you say it's fair to say she invented the Super Bowl halftime?
Definitely.
She one particular sermon about stopping your progress and thinking about what to do before God is, she roars up the aisle on a big Indian motorcycle, dressed as a motorcycle cop, gets to the stage, and tells people, proceeds to lecture then for half an hour about how you are arrested by God's desire for your soul. You need to turn around. You need to go on his green light, stop for his red light. People are just flabbergasted. They've never had this kind of teaching before. And painted against the development.
Big visual aids.
Oh, my
definitely.
Gracious. The gypsies in L.A., several hundred, always attended her her meetings and actually elected her their queen. They were so impressed. And
the gypsies.
She's a gypsy queen, man.
With all of that theatrical flair, not a very cautious, balanced individual, but my goodness, she just leaped out there and presented the theater. And we got to say, this produced results.
I'll tell you, in an age and country of P.T. Barnum, I bet this went over big time.
Absolutely. You know, 1921 becomes a real pivotal year, though. We talked about how she had the vision, which kind of resulted in the formation of the International Church of the Foursquare Gospel. But also, she begins to have a reputation of being a healer. And in 1921, she pulls a woman who had been crippled in a wheelchair, pulls her out, and this woman is healed. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, she gets a huge reputation and becomes a very prominent person. Also at this time, she begins another first in her life, the first to cross the U.S. continent unaccompanied by a man in an automobile. She also becomes the first woman in the United States to ever preach on the radio. She begins using the medium of radio, and actually later applies for and gets her own radio station, the third radio station issued to Los Angeles. And she becomes the first woman in the United States to actually own a radio station.
Way to go, Amy.
KFSG, the Foursquare Gospel. Huh. You know, back in those days, there were so few radio stations, you could get the initials you wanted to go with anything you wanted to do. And so she becomes the first real woman broadcaster and station owner in the United States as well.
Well, needless to say, this activity can't be contained in a small venue. So within a year or two, what you see is the building of a multi-million dollar Angelus Temple, which still exists today in Los
Absolutely,
Angeles.
Absolutely,
isn't it
yes.
home to five congregations and
still going strong?
And schools, magazines, publishing presses, mission outreaches, soup kitchens. The number of things that Amy got going. I mean, she put her hand to something and just got all these activities spun up, and this resulted in we couldn't even count the thousands of people who were fed, clothed, brought to Christ, taught, given degrees in mission work and divinity, and sent out. I don't know, boy. You get a person this unbalanced, and you kind of want to be careful and stay away from them. But the fact is, God brings forth tremendous fruit out of this unguarded, crazy woman.
Now we could also say about Angelus Temple that this is what you'd call a first cabin kind of facility.
Oh,
this is a circular. This is a circular church. The whole building is in a, built in a big round circle, and it
still
has
a tourist stop.
Has 5,000 seats in it. It has a huge stage in the front of it with an orchestra pit, and a huge choir loft that comes behind, you know, the stage and the orchestra pit. And Amy would sit on a large red velvet throne as she got ready to give, you know.
The gypsies love this.
Yeah, she really, you know, she really.
I'm seeing Americans eating this stuff up. This is not British.
On the top of the temple is this giant glowing 50-foot cross that's seen for 50 miles in every direction.
It rotates in a circle. It goes around in a circle. And at the time in L.A., you know, of course, this is pre-heavy smog.
Yeah.
You could apparently see this for a 50-mile radius. The cross was so big and illuminated, the cross on top of Angela's temple. So this woman, you know, once again, she had a lot of flair in every single thing that she ever did.
However, if you do a lot of good work for God, you also tend to attract the attention of God's enemy. And Amy certainly did. It wasn't long after the height of all of this, which is, coming up on the Depression, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
25 or something, that she is kidnapped, apparently. Now, I use that with quotation marks because she disappears for 6 weeks. She's last seen at a Santa Monica beach.
In a bathing suit.
In a bathing suit in L.A. Disappears for 6 weeks. Her mom proceeds to just run the service as it normally goes that evening. And then at the end of the service announces that Sister Amy, she was known as Sister to everybody, has presumably drowned and has gone to be with the Lord. And they even had a memorial service for her. And
what kind of thing is this, though, that, you know, someone's daughter drowns and the mom goes and does the church service as usual that night,
yeah,
and then at the end says, oh, and by the way, Esther's dead. Thought I might want to mention that to you guys, you
goodness
know.
Gracious.
It's a little strange. But she shows up 6 weeks later, fully clothed, wearing a corset and clean patent leather shoes, and claims to have been taken down to a shack in Mexico and held captive down there, and they finally let her go. And she wanders back into Arizona and claiming to have walked 13 miles without a single scuff on her shoes. And no one really knows what exactly happened. There's all sorts of wild rumors floating around that are all of them scandalous, and I don't really want to bring it up because the one thing that is missing from all this, the grand jury in L.A. tried to bring a case against her because two people had died in the process of trying to find her body because people were so whipped up into a frenzy about her drowning and the possibility of her drowning that they wanted to bring charges against her. But they really could never find any person to actually testify against her who was a credible witness. And after 6 weeks, the case eventually was just dropped, probably because she was such a high-profile person and so well liked in Los Angeles that they knew they were swimming against the tide.
It almost doesn't matter what happened because from this point forward, the rest of her ministry for many years was, I won't say tainted, but it was always compromised by the presence of, at one point she had 45 litigations and suits pending against her. Her enemies, and God's enemies, frankly, used this as an opportunity to just hound her and go after her. Although, her ministry continued strong all through the Depression, right up through, she would take outreach mission trips right up through World War II, and she finally died at the age of 54 in
Oakland, California. She had a terrible, terrific problem the last few years of her life with insomnia. And small wonder, you know, she had lots of personal problems. She had lots of family problems. But also she worked, you know, an insane schedule. She preached more than 20 times a week. She was continually writing, continually broadcasting, coming up with dramas, all these different things. So she was, you know, really in a position of incredible overwork all the time, and included in leading, you know, this church with this massive outreach. And so, you know, you get that tired and you have that much stuff going on in your mind, you struggle with insomnia. And the last few years of her life, she really became very heavily dependent upon sleeping pills to sleep at night.
Mm-hmm.
And normally it would take several pills to even knock her out to get a decent night's sleep. And while she was in Oakland, California for that final speaking engagement, she had just gotten a new prescription, and she really had no idea about the power of these new barbiturates that she was taking. And she just popped a few in just like normal and woke up and thought, well, these were great, and took some more. and ended up dying of an overdose. Nobody in their right mind who knows her or anybody said it was a suicide. I mean, at the time and today, you know, everybody says, no, it was an accidental overdose. But she died a very, you know, very young and very, I think, a very tragic death.
Her funeral was on her birthday in 1944 and drew 150,000 people, or 50,000
people.
Which is pretty unheard of. I mean, even for kings and presidents and movie stars in that day. Hollywood even did kind of a movie on this in 1960. It's Elmer Gantry, in which they were very tongue-in-cheek, were careful not to paint the Amy Semple McPherson character with scandal. What they did was they used Burt Lancaster as the aside. You've seen that?
I haven't seen the movie.
Right.
But
it's worth seeing. I mean, it's a good movie. You got to be careful, though, because you know Hollywood. If changing the truth a little bit will improve the storytelling capacity, they're want to do that sort of thing. But it does give you a good taste of the flavor and the extent of the ministry that that Amy was running.
And as in life, so in death, Amy is buried in an extremely, extremely elaborate tomb, rivaling that of even President John F. Kennedy's as far as the size and the outlay of it. And she's buried in Forest Lawn Cemetery, where all good Los Angeles celebrities are all buried. Anyway, quite an interesting story. And
boy, modern historians actually peg her as being, along with Billy Sunday, probably the most prominent and influential evangelist of the early 20th century in this country. I mean, she just really touched lives. And again, one of the things I just love the most is the fact that, you know, we go looking through the annals of history for the gemstones, if you will, and we find some really wonderful stories and personalities. But the fact is, none of these people are perfect people. None of these people are, you got as role models, basically what they share in common, just as Amy did, is the willingness to be led by God and to just unafraid leap out and start doing things for God. And if you can work balance and discretion in there, that's great, but it's not an obstacle to the Lord if you forget those things along the way.
I think it's also important to remember, Matt, that, you know, big people have big faults.
Amen.
That's just a bottom line. Big people have the capacity to do big things, but they usually have big faults, and we should, you know, always bear that in mind. She was a very flamboyant person. She loved the masses. The masses loved her.
She's very passionate.
You know, she loved deeply, but then she had a messed up private life. But thousands were helped. Thousands were healed. Thousands were trained by her ministry. You know, what more can you ask? Can I just add a couple?
No, I absolutely forbid
you,
it.
You forbid it? Okay.
Go ahead. I just wanted like 40 seconds.
I just wanted to add a couple of great books if people are interested. And the reason I would recommend these in particular are because, most of all, they've been written long enough after the fact that they tend to present Amy in a more balanced way and using more of a historical background. Anyway, Sister Amy, absolutely a fabulous read, came out 2 years ago by Daniel Mark Epstein. Highly recommend that. And another one by Robert Baer called The Least of All Saints. And very enjoyable, and will definitely fill in a lot of the story about Amy.
Matt and Chris, as always, a great report here. Thank you for taking the time to come in. It's In Touch next to Charles Stanley. I'm Pat Daly. Bless you.
There is power in joy. The joy of the Lord is your strength.